the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler, and we always talk about longevity here on the program and being proactive in caring for your health. Our guest today is going to be Bob Marchini, author of Brotherhood of the Balloon, New Proton Beam Therapies for Prostate Cancer. We know that Social Security and Medicare both constitute our nation's largest expenditure, representing 23% of the government's budget. It is the fastest growing expense within the government's budget as well, especially due to large numbers of baby boomer retirees. Despite the significance of programs on retirement, most retired Americans are not making the best choices when it comes to decisions for Social Security or Medicare. And they're making some very, very foolish and costly mistakes when it comes to their Social Security benefits. So on today's show, we're going to cover how to avoid 10 costly mistakes which you should avoid regarding your Social Security benefits. For many Americans, Social Security is one benefit they can count on in this era of financial repression. So we're going to discuss not only avoiding making mistakes with it, but how to maximize benefits. All right, Jim, we have a countdown here, 10 items. Let's begin.
Well, you know, John, one of the reasons you see so many mistakes made when it comes to Social Security and Medicare, there's so many variables when it comes to Social Security, the rules. But the decision, here's the tragic part, the decision you make claiming your benefit payment you will receive in retirement, if you sign up too soon or don't work long enough, your Social Security benefits are going to be reduced. And there are a number of mistakes that could have a major impact on the benefits that you're going to receive throughout your retirement. And the one thing that we have talked here on previous programs, the one issue that is coming up and creating more problems for retirees is the fact that our lifespans have increased. So assets have to take care of you over a longer period of time. So the decision in terms of when you claim or the decisions you make for both you and your spouse have very dramatic impacts on your retirement, because that benefit, whatever you choose, that's going to be paid over a longer period of time. And that's why the first mistake is not working 35 years. Now, here's something that a lot of people aren't aware of. Social Security benefits are based on your average earnings over a 35-year period. So if you didn't work for 35 years, guess what? The years you didn't work in the 35-year calculation, Social Security puts in a zero for that year and averages that into your overall earnings during a 35-year period of time. So a lot of people think, John, that, oh, you know, I make the big bucks the last 5 years or last 10 years before I retire. Well, that's only 10 years in a 35-year calculation. So the first mistake really is not working 35 years.
Okay, you know, you might never know that it's based on a 35-year averaging of income. And you could suspect that it impacts a lot of people, such as, say, for example, women who might have gone into the workforce late or taken years off to raise children and then go back into the workforce. Now, do you know if they're consecutive years, or where do they put a benchmark for that anyway?
It's just 35 years. It's a rolling 35-year average. So if, let's say, you took 5 years off to, let's say, raise children, as my wife did, 5 years taken off, those are zeros that are put in that year for your income. So those zeros are averaged in with the other 35 years. So if you didn't work for 5 years, you got 5 years of zeros. But the next mistake is not maximizing your earnings. Now, obviously, that's a function of what you do as a job. Most individuals pay 6.2% on a certain base level of Social Security. You can multiply that times two if you're self-employed. Now, this year, the limit is $118,500. So the first $118,500, if you are self-employed, you're going to pay 12.4% against that $118,000, or 6.2% if you're an employee. Now, if you can boost your income by a raise or, let's say, get a better job, the more pay, obviously, you're going to pay more taxes into Social Security, but that's also going to serve to increase your benefits. The more you pay, the more you get.
Now, what if you get the big bucks, say, for example, you know, as your career is going on, you're making more money progressively. What if the big bucks come in for the last 5 or 10 years of your career before you begin collecting Social Security?
You know, let's say your average is $50,000 a year over the first 30 years, and you make $100,000, let's say, your last 5 years. That's only 5 years of $100,000 that are averaged in with 30 years of lesser earnings. So its impact is not going to be as great as you think it is, because for one, there's only a base of which Social Security is assessed. So it's not like, okay, what if you go making $250,000, $300,000 or mega bucks? Well, you only pay Social Security taxes, like for example, this year on the first $118,500. So it really isn't going to make that much of an impact on your Social Security benefits. Now, if you did that over a 10 or 15 year period of time, you were paying the max into Social Security, that would have a benefit, but not if it's just for 5 or 10 years. It'll get averaged in with the other 25 years or 30 years. Now, let's talk about another big mistake. Boy, this is one of the biggest ones. And that is to sign up as soon as possible, which today is at age 62. Now, this not only reduces your benefit by 25%, but will affect your retirement finances for the rest of your life and that of your spouse. Because remember, at age 62, when your wife turns 62, she gets half of your benefits. So not only are you going to get a reduced benefit, but in the case if you're the main breadwinner, your wife is also going to get less. So it's a mistake, John, that I can't emphasize it over enough. A lot of people think, well, I'll take it at age 62 because I'll be getting it over a longer period of time. They don't realize that they're giving up 25% of their benefit. And if you take a life expectancy for a male today in the 80s and a female into the mid 80s, that is a considerable reduction of benefits over a lifetime spent in retirement.
You know, you're right, Jim. A number of studies are showing this to be the most common and biggest Social Security mistake. People think the earlier they get it, the more they will get, forgetting about longevity, because it means you get lower benefit over a longer time period. You have to actually sit down and do the calculations to see this.
That's why you're seeing, as you'll see in some of the case studies, you're better off, especially if you don't need the income and you want to maximize your benefits, is to defer the benefit. Either one, defer it till full retirement age or age 70. But another common mistake is, John, not knowing this full retirement age, because you know that they change that for you and I. It used to be you could get your benefits at age 62 and then full benefits at age 65. Well, that's been shifted up by 2 additional years to age 66 and age 67. It actually increases if you were born 1937 or earlier, full retirement age is 65. 1938, it's 65 and 2 months. And then, for example, if you were born after 1943, it goes to 66. And after 1960, it goes to 67. So knowing the impact of full retirement age is also not just the fact that you get your full benefit, but also the fact that you could be forfeiting part of your benefit if you work and receive Social Security, depending on your level of income. Where if you wait to full retirement benefit, the nice thing about that is you can work and earn as much as you want, and they're not going to penalize and take away your Social Security benefits.
Yeah, and essentially what they're doing here is they're moving back the full retirement age by 2 years, depending on when you were born. And frankly, they're likely to do it again, you know, another 2 years to age 69 due to the funding issues and problems they're going to have. And well, not only that, but solvency as far as the U.S. government is concerned, and the fact that people are living longer. Let's face it, there is a crisis issue here for the government itself.
Yeah, I recently attended a conference on Social Security. And John, there are a number of things they need to do. And unfortunately, politicians don't do anything until there's a crisis. And then, you know what they do? The media hypes it. And there's a lot of hyperbole coming up from both sides. But we know that people are living longer, which means that they're drawing on these benefits for a longer period of time. Well, they move the age 2 years for you and I, and they know they need to do it again because of longevity. As I mentioned earlier, men are living into their 80s, women into their mid-80s, and there's a 50% chance at age 65 that one of the two of you, if you're married, will live to age 90. So we know it's coming, that more likely if you are a millennial, right now, chances are the age for Social Security is going to be moving to, let's say, age of 68 and age 69. And there will probably be a slight increase in the Social Security tax from 6.2%. It might go to 7%. But we know that that is coming. Now, let's talk about something else that people don't realize the full benefit of. And that's not just waiting to full retirement age, but it's also considering delaying your claim until age 70. Now, the one thing that's good about that, let's say you reach age 66, you can file and suspend. We'll talk about what that means in a minute. And then what you can do is delay receiving your Social Security. It's going to increase by 8% every single year to age 70. Now, there's a number of things that that's going to do. I don't know, number one, of any investment today that will guarantee an 8% increase every single year. That's number one. And this decision should be made. Obviously, there's a number of reasons whether you should delay. That's obviously going to depend on your own health, your family history. But the fact remains, individuals are living longer today. And the longer you think you will live, the greater the benefits are of delaying to age 70.
And what we're discussing here is the idea that Social Security, especially due to longevity and other changes which have gone on in the economic environment, is really the last guaranteed pension benefit that most people can get. So when planning for it, when implementing it, and even after you have retired, you need to make wise choices and to monitor your benefit plan.
Yeah, because another costly decision is not looking at the benefits and, more importantly, coordinating those benefits with the spouse. For example, spouses are entitled to 50% of the higher earner's Social Security payment. So let's say the husband is the main breadwinner. Let's say he had the largest salary. Then his wife is entitled to 50% of those benefits. So let's say a husband, let's say there's a 4-year age difference. Husband turns age 66. If the wife is age 62, she can claim 50% of her husband's benefits. And there's two strategies that you can use here. You can use one called file and suspend. The husband files for his benefits so his wife can get 50% of his Social Security, but then he suspends payments and allows his benefits to grow for 8% a year for the next 4 years until he reaches age 70. Now, when he does that, there's a number of things that can happen. The wife takes the 50% benefit of his Social Security and she does a file and restrict. Let's say she's age 62. By file and restricting, she's going to take 50% of her husband's Social Security benefit. But then she allows her own Social Security benefit to grow at 8% a year. So it grows to age 70. And at age 70, if, let's say, the husband filed and suspended, his benefit is going to be so much larger, which his wife has a number of choices. She could either switch to her own benefit if it's larger than her husband's one half, or in the case of, let's say, the husband predeceases the wife, then she's going to receive a larger benefit. So there are a number of things going on here, but it's really important when you file for your Social Security benefits, it's a joint decision, and you make that decision based on maximizing the benefits for both of you.
Now, what about survivor's benefits if one spouse, especially the higher earner, passes away?
Well, in that case, the survivor can take the larger of the two Social Security payments. But one strategy not considered, as I just mentioned, is this file and suspend strategy for the husband. And especially if he doesn't need that income, he could file, giving his wife 50% of his Social Security benefit, assuming she's age 62, and then he can allow his benefit to compound for 4 years. So at age 70, it's going to be much larger. And I'll illustrate this in just a second, because it's going to grow by 8% a year, which means a larger survivor benefit for the wife, which could be very substantial. And I want to give an example here. The maximum benefit that you can receive from Social Security today in 2015 is $2,663 a month. Now, that adds up to $31,995 a year. Let's just round it off and say $32,000. Now, if you file and suspend at age 66, that means this benefit is going to grow at 8% a year until age 70. At age 70, the benefit will go from $32,000 a year to $43,500, that's almost $11,500 more income for the surviving spouse should the husband predecease his wife. So there's a number of benefits here for surviving spouses, and the spouse isn't losing anything if the husband files and suspends, because as long as she's 62, she can get 50% of her husband's Social Security benefit, while his continues to compound and grow at 8% a year for the next 4 years until he turns age 70.
Why don't we take an example here? You have a loss of Social Security, loss of benefits due to the death of one spouse.
Well, let's go back to the example I just mentioned where, let's say at age 66, the husband paid the max into Social Security. He has a benefit of $32,000. The wife, assuming she's age 62, could get half of that. That's $16,000. So if the husband files and suspends, the wife is going to get a Social Security benefit of $16,000. Her benefits at age 70 would be roughly $17,320. That's assuming a 2% cost of living. Now, let's say the husband dies. If you take his age at age 70, let's say he dies at age 70 with 2% cost of living, that $32,000 over the next 4 years would grow to $34,632. But let's suppose instead of taking his benefit at age 66, he allows it to accumulate at 8% a year to age 70. At age 70, his benefit would be $43,476. Now, let's assume he dies at age 70. The wife could get rid of her Social Security, because you only get one. Her Social Security would have been $17,320. She can switch to her husband's, which would be $43,476. It roughly covers almost half of the loss of her own Social Security benefits. And this is just another way to maximize Social Security benefits for a surviving spouse.
I want to come back to probably the biggest mistake in Social Security. I hear people say, well, I'm going to get it as early as I can, claiming Social Security benefits at age 62. They may find they need more income, say, for example, right now. So they wind up going to work, ending up losing part of their benefits, which permanently lowers the benefits for the rest of their life.
Well, I mean, there's a number of things that you can do. If you, let's say, file at age 62 and you find out you're going to have to go back to work, as long as you did not receive the benefits for more than 12 months, you can actually go back and redo your Social Security. But here's the problem. You're going to have to pay back all of the money that you received. And that's all the money that you received for not only just your own self, but let's say a spouse or children in this case. Here's the problem. Let's say you file at age 62 and you decide, hey, I can't make it on Social Security, so I'm going to have to work. You start working. Well, you're going to lose benefits for every $2 that you make over those limits. What happens is they start reducing your benefits by a dollar. So you start losing the benefits that you receive. Your benefits are 25% lower, and those benefits are going to be lower for the rest of your life, even though they're going to penalize you because you're working. So if you do find yourself in that situation, hopefully you discover it early on, either you're working with an advisor, because if you receive those benefits for less than 12 months, as long as you pay them back, they're not going to charge you any interest or anything like that, but you can actually pay the money back and then you can redo your Social Security, let's say, waiting to the full retirement age. Another thing that also happens too is taxation of Social Security. Now, John, you and I are old enough to remember Social Security was tax-free. Then in 1984, when they first amended Social Security, they made 50% of the benefits taxable. So if you're single, between $25,000 and $34,000, up to 50% of your Social Security could become taxable. If you are single, making over $34,000, 85% of your Social Security benefits become taxable. For a married couple, between $32,000 and $44,000, 50% of your Social Security benefits are taxable, and making over $44,000, then 85% of your Social Security benefits are taxable. And there are a number of ways, especially in the lower income groups, where you can use some ways to shelter that or get below that. For example, the use of immediate annuities, MLPs, or things that are partially sheltered. And so you need to understand when the taxation rules come in. You also need to understand if you file early at age 62, the loss of benefits if you continue to work. And another mistake, John, people make is they don't monitor their Social Security benefits, that of themselves and that of their spouse. So they don't know what the options are going to be at age 62, age 66, or if they file and suspend or file and restrict.
Now, what if they make this mistake and they realize it? In other words, later on, they discover it. Can they reverse this decision?
They can, once again, if they do it less than 12 months. If you make the decision and you've been receiving benefits over 12 months, it's irreversible. You're stuck with it. So the real key is if you've made this decision, and maybe you're listening to this program and you just made this decision, and it's less than 12 months, as long as you pay it back. And that means not only just your own benefits, but also if your spouse started receiving them as well or any dependent children, then as long as you pay it back, they're not going to charge you any interest, but you have to pay back the full benefits. Then you can restart it again at a later time.
Well, as you can see, there are many rules which people need to know about when it comes to claiming Social Security benefits. What you want to be able to do is to make sure that you understand your options. So coordinate with your spouse if you're married or even divorced. So in the end, you maximize both of your benefits. Otherwise, you may wind up being penalized by them. All right, Jim, we need to move on to this week's case study to illustrate some of the concepts we have discussed here on avoiding and making costly mistakes and maximizing Social Security benefits. As with all of our life studies, the studies are actual cases, but we change names to protect privacy.
The first case we're going to talk about is Bob and Carol. They've been married about 40 years. Bob is age 66 as of January of this year. He worked for a big-name technology firm. He retired at age 62, and he taught part-time at a local college. His wife, Carol, will be 62 in a couple months, primarily worked part-time in a lower-paying job due to child care responsibilities. The challenge is the income Bob gets from teaching computer science at a local community college just covers their basic living expenses. He insists they do not take any withdrawals from his retirement account or that they own jointly. Bob intends to delay filing for Social Security until he's age 70 so that his benefit is bigger due to the delayed retirement credit. Carol is tired of arguing about money. She wants to begin Social Security as soon as she turns 62, so she will have her own income to spend as she wants. Basically, as we took a look at this situation, the full retirement benefits for Bob at age 66, they'd be roughly about $2,000. In this case, the best strategy, Bob files just as he wants and suspends at age 66. So that allows his Social Security benefits to accumulate at 8% a year at age 70. Now, Carol files and restricts for spousal benefits. She will get half of Bob's benefits, and that will begin immediately. Bob then files for his own benefits at age 70, and Carol switches to survivor benefits at age 90. That's assuming Bob lives his normal life expectancy. So here was a case where Carol was able to basically get her Social Security benefits, get some additional money coming in, getting half of her husband's Social Security. In the meantime, Bob allows his Social Security to accumulate until age 70, where he's going to get a maximum benefit in the long run. Assuming that he predeceases his wife, Carol, Carol would have a bigger benefit when she claims her husband's benefit. And this is something that we see happen quite frequently, John, where you file a suspend, and it makes a real big difference when it comes to what happens in terms of ultimately the benefits for both. Because remember, as a spouse, you are entitled to 50% of the larger spouse's Social Security benefit, even though that spouse may file and suspend and allow it to accumulate. So at least one Social Security check is going to be coming in. Now, I want to do another case. We'll call this Clem and Goldie. They have three children. Two of them are from her previous marriage. Clem is age 64. As of June of last year, he was a partner in a national advertising firm. His wife, Goldie, 46, this year, she's an executive assistant for a national advertising firm for 10 years before retiring. Current occupation, as she says, soccer mom. They have three children, Lauren, age 16, Matt, 14, Clem, Jr., at age 6. The challenge, Clem's second hip surgery, was a wake-up call. He decided to finally retire from a lifelong career in advertising, and thanks to the sale of his partnership stake in the firm, he's set for life in terms of income. Nonetheless, he still wants to be sure he receives everything he's entitled to in terms of Social Security. In this case, what Clem would do was file for benefits at age 70, which would be roughly in the year 2021. Goldie files for benefits at age 62 because of this major age difference. That would be roughly July of 31. And then Goldie switches to survivor benefits at age 74, given the life difference between them of 18 years. And so here, once again, Clem doesn't need it. So he basically doesn't even file and suspend because the age difference, unfortunately, Goldie's not age 62. She's 46, so she couldn't get any of his benefits. But John, here was an example where there was an age difference and a second marriage. But in either case, we didn't file and suspend. We just basically didn't file, giving Clem the larger benefit, age 70, which ultimately would go to his wife, Goldie, later on.
And coming up next on the program, Bob Marchini, the Brotherhood of the Balloon. It sounds interesting, doesn't it? Well, in reality, it's about a new therapy for prostate cancer, which seems to be much more effective with far, far fewer side effects than surgery or some of the other options. It's called proton beam therapy, and more centers offering this treatment are springing up around the country. All of that coming up next as Lifetime Income continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, each year in the United States, over 220,000 new cases of prostate cancer are announced. About 27 or almost 28,000 men will die of prostate cancer each year. One man in seven will be diagnosed with prostate cancer during his lifetime. And prostate cancer occurs mainly in older men. We normally see it. Six cases in 10 are men over age 65. But we're also seeing it at a younger age. Joining me on the program today is Robert J. Marchini. He's author of the book, You Can Beat Prostate Cancer, and You Don't Need Surgery to Do It. Bob, for our listeners, why don't you fill in our audience a little bit of your own journey of prostate cancer, which ran in your family, not only with your father and brother, as well as yourself. Take us through that and what led you to write this book.
Sure, Jim. I was diagnosed about 15 years ago with prostate cancer, but my journey actually began about 2 years before that when my older brother was diagnosed with prostate cancer. And he did what most people did in those days. He followed his urologist's advice and he chose surgery, which then was considered to be the, quote, gold standard. I drove my brother to the hospital that day, he and his wife, and I waited, and then I was with him in the recovery room 4 hours later. And what I saw there scared me to death, and it changed me forever. My brother walked in, the picture of health. He had no symptoms whatsoever, just high PSA and a biopsy that indicated he had prostate cancer. But 4 hours later, he had lost 6 pints of blood. He was hooked up to a lot of machines. He was gray and pasty looking. And he looked like the picture of death. And I remember while I was in the recovery room with him that I made a decision that if I am ever diagnosed with prostate cancer, I'm going to find something better than surgery. And sure enough, a couple of years later, I was diagnosed. So I set out to find something that was better than what I considered to be barbaric treatment. And in that process, I interviewed lots of doctors. And the more doctors I interviewed, the more complicated things were and the more confused I became. The urologist felt I was perfect for surgery. The radiation oncologist felt that I was the poster child for external beam radiation. The brachytherapy guy felt that I was perfect for seeds, and the cryotherapy guy felt that that would have been my best option. So the more doctors I spoke with, the more confused I became. So I kind of shifted my focus to interviewing former patients. And as I interviewed former patients, information started coming to me in droves. I had some difficulty at first having doctors let me speak with their patients, so I found other ways to get to them. What I learned when I spoke with surgery patients was that maybe 7 out of 10 were experiencing erectile dysfunction. Maybe 3 or 4 out of 10 were incontinent, lust of bladder control. And there were other issues, strictures and things like that. And it frightened me quite a bit. I had similar experience when I spoke with men who had external beam radiation and seeds, although less severe complications. And I stumbled upon something called proton beam radiation therapy that was only being practiced at Loma Linda University Medical Center in Southern California. And on paper, it sounded too good to be true. So I contacted them and I asked if I could speak with former patients. And what surprised me was they said, sure. And they faxed me a list of 30 former patients to contact. And I contacted as many of them as I could reach. And there were about 20 that I could reach. But I also asked each one of the 20 that I reached if I could speak with people that they went through treatment with. I wanted to make sure that Loma Linda didn't just give me their success cases. So I came up with a list of another 36 names, and I spoke with them as well. And what I heard was very exciting. Their disease was under control, and their quality of life after treatment was superb. So I made my decision to have proton therapy 15 years ago, and it was probably the best decision I've ever made.
Let's, for our listeners, get back to some basics here, because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding in terms of treatment, diagnosis, the steps that need to be taken, how to prevent it as well as treat it. Let's begin with just some basic things. The prostate, where is it located and what is its function? I mean, if it's being taken out, you're taking an organ out of your body. What happens when that happens?
Good question. The prostate is an organ that is supposed to be roughly the size of a walnut. As men grow older, it can enlarge and usually does enlarge, sometimes to the size of a lemon and sometimes even the size of an orange or even larger. There's a disease that's referred to as BPH, which is an enlarged prostate, which is not necessarily related to prostate cancer, but it does happen in older men. But the prostate itself is located at the base of the bladder. And its function is to produce fluid that activates the sperm and helps propel it out of the body. So that's where it's located, and that's its function.
So given that function, let's talk about things that you can do to prevent prostate cancer. Is there anything, or has science given us something that says, hey, if you do these things, you're more likely to avoid it? In other words, are there steps, like we know with heart disease, a healthier diet and exercise helps combat, let's say, the onset of heart disease. What about prostate cancer?
Another good question. There are certain things that we have control over, and it can definitely influence prostate cancer, either the onset of it or even the degree of aggressiveness. For example, maintaining proper body weight. Obesity promotes many forms of cancer, and especially prostate cancer. Smoking. Avoid smoking at all costs because it does promote many types of cancer, including prostate cancer. Diet is a contributing factor. Red meats and animal fats contribute to cancers of many types, including prostate cancer. So people should be minimizing red meats and animal fats and focusing on fruits and vegetables, particularly cruciferous vegetables like broccoli, cauliflower, and things like that. Exercise is very important for preventing cancers of all types, including prostate cancer. Oxygenating your body through aerobic exercise is great. And of course, the last thing you can do to prevent prostate cancer is to choose the right parents, because there is a genetic component.
All right. So there are things you can do to prevent it. Now, let's talk about its diagnosis. One of the things that really struck me, Bob, is two of my favorite authors. I like geopolitical thrillers, and Tom Clancy and Vince Flynn, both very smart gentlemen, very successful people in their lives. They both died within months of each other in 2013. In the case of Vince Flynn, he had difficulty sitting, writing, before he finally got his diagnosed, and by then it was too late. And the same thing with Tom Clancy, who had open heart surgery. So what can individuals do to detect prostate cancer? Are there steps or are there tests that are definitive that can detect it early?
Yes, as a matter of fact. And it's interesting because there's a lot of controversy right now. You may be aware of the fact that the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force has recommended against prostate screening, which I think is a huge mistake. In the case of Clancy and Flynn, I don't know for sure, but I would guess that because they were very busy men and they probably felt good most of the time. They probably either did not have frequent physicals or they were not monitoring their PSA because it's a very simple blood test. And it's not necessarily directly correlatable with prostate cancer, but it's a marker. It's a reference point. So if they had been doing these things and they caught it early, prostate cancer is a bump in the road if you catch it early. If you catch it late, it can be pretty nasty. And of course, the way to catch it early is to have annual physical examinations. And if you're a male and there's no history of prostate cancer in your family, you should be having a PSA blood test and a digital rectal exam from age 50 and up. If you have prostate cancer in your family, as I did, I had an older brother and a father, I should have been having my PSA screenings beginning at age 40, but I didn't know the things that I know today. So that's the best way to get started. Now, if you had elevated PSA and or the doctor feels a lump in the prostate when he does the digital rectal exam, then you should go for a biopsy. Today, biopsies are done by most urologists the same way they were doing them 25 years ago. And I'm not happy about that at all. It's called a blind biopsy, where they go in and they take random samples from the prostate, maybe 10 or 12 or 15. And if they don't see it, when they look at it under a microscope in the pathology slides, they tell you that you don't have prostate cancer. But the biopsy itself, when it's done as a blind biopsy, takes, you know, less than 1% of the volume of the prostate and samples it. And they could easily miss lesions that are there. There is new technology available today that allows physicians to image the prostate and look for hot spots. And then that allows the urologist to target the hot spots when they're doing the biopsy. But surprisingly, a very, very small percentage of urologists today are doing the targeted biopsy. There's a great book, by the way, that came out last year. It's called Prostate Cancer Breakthroughs 2014 by Dr. Jay Cohen. He'd be a great guy, I think, for you to interview sometime, by the way. It talks about these new state-of-the-art imaging techniques, which really help the doctor diagnose the cancer early. It also helps determine, even before a biopsy, if the lesion is predicted to be aggressive. And in many cases, if not most cases for early prostate cancer, it's non-aggressive and no treatment is necessary at all. Patients can do active surveillance. But you can't make those kinds of decisions unless you do the proper imaging and do the proper biopsy of the prostate.
Bob, are there certain men that are more likely to be at higher risk than others? In other words, we talked about, you know, the best thing you can do is choose great parents or great genes. Mm-hmm. But are there certain men that tend to be more susceptible to the disease?
Yes. Of course, if you have prostate cancer in your family, if you have one close relative, brother, father, cousin, whatever, your risk doubles. So instead of 1 out of 6 or 1 out of 7, it becomes 2 out of 6 or 7. So a family history is a critically important measure. But in addition to that, there's a higher incidence of prostate cancer diagnosed in men in North America and Western Europe, and less so for people who live in Asia, as an example. A lot of that, we believe, has to do with diet, because when Asians move to the United States and they pick up a Western diet, we find that their statistics increase dramatically. African-American men are significantly at higher risk, maybe at least double that of those from North America and Western Europe. So, you know, African-Americans should probably begin testing at age 40.
Let me ask you this. You mentioned that the government is recommending no longer screening for prostate or doing tests. I think they said something similar about breast cancer. Why the change? Is there something wrong about these screenings? In other words, when I go in for an annual physical, I get the kind of exams you just mentioned, and part of them is a PSA exam. So what's wrong with having those kind of exams, and why would they recommend not doing that?
Well, it's a great question. And the answer is that, you know, they can point to statistics that many, if not most, men who are diagnosed with prostate cancer, if they left it untreated, would probably die from something other than prostate cancer. And that's probably true. They conclude that, well, then men who have themselves treated for prostate cancer very often have significant side effects which affect the quality of their life, impotence, incontinence, strictures, and whatever, even death. One out of 200 men who have surgery under the age of 70 die as a result of the procedure. And if you're over 70, it's one out of 100. So that's about a 1% chance of dying. So they say, well, you know, rather than risk dying and rather than risk impotence and incontinence and all the rest, don't have the test. And I think that's a foolish conclusion. The problem is not over-testing or over-diagnosing. The problem is over-treating. So if you diagnose a man with prostate cancer, which is early stage, and the stage is measured by the PSA, the Gleason score on a scale of 1 to 10, it's staged T1 through T4 based on the digital rectal exam and whether there are any lumps, palpable lesions in the prostate. So if you're an early stage patient and you have a reasonable lifespan or whatever, you're a prime candidate for doing something called active surveillance, where you monitor your PSA, have periodic biopsies, and then just get on with your life. But what was happening in the past is that once a man discovered that he had prostate cancer, he'd go to his urologist and say, check it out, get it out. And in many cases, if not most cases, certainly with early stage prostate cancer, it's not necessary to go through that procedure and run the risk of the side effects and possibly death, as I mentioned earlier. So again, the problem is not overdiagnosis, it's overtreating. So educate the doctors, educate the patients, and collect the information, get yourself diagnosed early, and then make an educated and informed decision as to whether you want any treatment at all. And if you do decide to have treatment, then examine all the treatment options and pick the one that's A, going to destroy the cancer, and B, leave you with the best quality of life after treatment. And I certainly found that one.
Well, let's talk about treatment options before getting to your book, because in your book, you go through every treatment option as you were looking at your own disease, looking at a solution. You have an engineering background, and you really sort of went at this from an engineering point of view. You looked at every single option, the pluses, the minuses. So what are the options to somebody that is diagnosed with prostate cancer?
There are many, many options, and there are more all the time. Once again, you know, in the past, the quote gold standard was surgery, you know, remove the prostate, and that comes with a whole assortment of potential side effects. The next most common treatment option would be some form of external beam radiation. Typically, that's x-rays, and there are advanced forms of external beam radiation using x-rays. There are many types, you know, IMRT, which is intensity modulated radiation therapy, and rapid arc and CyberKnife, and they all have fancy names. They're all advanced forms of conventional x-ray radiation. Cryotherapy, which is the use of a liquid nitrogen to freeze the cancer. They typically freeze the entire prostate and destroy any cancer that might be there. High-intensity focused ultrasound uses heat to destroy the cancer. There's something new called focal laser ablation, where they go in with a laser beam and try to destroy the specific lesions in the prostate. That's starting to catch on. Of course, proton therapy, which is what I had. And the big advantage to proton is that they can send that beam very precisely into the prostate to do the work to destroy the cancer without doing damage to surrounding tissues and organs. The analogy that I use, and I believe I mentioned this in the book, the difference between proton radiation therapy and conventional radiation therapy, using a military analogy, is almost like a smart bomb that can be sent right down the chimney to destroy the house versus the cluster bomb that takes out the entire neighborhood. And when the target is your prostate and the neighborhood is your bladder and your rectum and other important parts of the male anatomy, you don't want to do collateral damage. And of course, the other option that you have, as I mentioned earlier, if you are early stage, is active surveillance, doing nothing but monitoring it and keeping track of your PSA and having biopsies every couple of years.
Now, you had your treatment 15 years ago. Let me ask you this. It's been 15 years. How are you today?
I'm doing great. My PSA has been below 1 since I was treated, and it was 8 before I had my treatment. Quality of my life, you might be surprised to hear this, but it's better than it was before treatment. And the reason for that is that one of the bonuses of going to Loma Linda University Medical Center is that their mission is to make man whole. So they treat the whole person, body, mind, and spirit. And while I was there, I learned a lot about how to prevent the cancer from returning, how to prevent other cancers from entering my body, how to become physically fit, the importance of maintaining proper body weight, diet, lifestyle. And even though my wife and I were not Seventh-day Adventists, the folks at Loma Linda, it's a Seventh-day Adventist hospital, but they teach you a lot about the importance of faith and spirituality in your life. And my wife and I became stronger in our faith as a result of our experience at Loma Linda. So my diet is better. My weight is under control. I'm very active physically. I swim 3 miles a week, a mile Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and I work out Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturdays. And I began that process when I went through treatment. And for that reason, I've never felt better. I'm now 72 years old, and I feel like a racehorse.
You know, every treatment, as you talk about in your book, has a side effect. What are the side effects of proton beam?
Well, for most of us, there are none. There can be some temporary side effects like urinary urgency, urinary burning, that sort of thing. There can, in some cases, be a little bit of rectal bleeding because when they treat the prostate, they treat a margin around the prostate to make sure that they get any cancer that's in the margins. And sometimes that margin overlaps with the anterior wall of the rectum. And as the healing takes place there, there can be a little bit of rectal bleeding. But for most of us, if it happens, it's temporary, it's painless, and it's self-limiting. There can be, for a small percentage of cases, some changes in sexual function. But what was most important to me, and is certainly most important to most men, there's almost a zero chance of loss of bladder control, incontinence. And that bothered me more than anything. I worried about that more than anything. And we now have, 8,000 members in our group, all former proton patients. And I'm not aware of a single case of loss of urinary control as a result of the proton treatment.
Let's talk about the cure rates, because as you mentioned, most people, and I have clients who have had prostate cancer, they've gone through prostate surgery and the removal of the prostate because it was called the gold standard. What are the cure rates of, let's say, proton beam versus, let's say, surgery?
Well, it's hard to find a lot of specific information on that because a lot of it depends upon the stage of the cancer when the patient was treated. But I can talk in general terms about it. First of all, there's a great misunderstanding with those who choose surgery. They believe that if I have my prostate removed, then cancer is a thing of the past. It's gone forever because my prostate is gone. And that's not necessarily the case. And the reason is that there's always a possibility and even a high probability in many cases that cancer has escaped the prostate and is in the margins in the tissue around the prostate. Even with early stage prostate cancer patients, there's something on the internet called the Partin tables, Dr. Partin, P-A-R-T-I-N. And you can go there and plug in your numbers. And in my case, even though I was early stage, very early stage, garden variety prostate cancer, there was a 17% chance of cancer in the margins. This is microscopic cancer. So the doctor can't see it when he's removing your prostate. So if they take out your prostate and you've got cancer in the margins, your cancer will likely return. So surgery is not a guarantee of a cure. One of the big advantages of proton therapy is that when they treat the patient, they treat the prostate, the capsule around the prostate, the local seminal vesicles, and they also treat a half-inch margin around that. That half-inch margin is where any cancer might be that might have escaped the gland. So my argument is that your chances of long-term cure are better with proton than with surgery. Now, one might say, well, gee, if you treat those margins with protons, why not just remove those margins with surgery? Well, you can't remove those margins because the margins include the base of the bladder, and it includes the anterior wall of the rectum. So you just can't remove those parts of the male anatomy. As far as cure rates go, there are a bunch of studies that we refer to on my website, by the way, protonbob.com, and I encourage your listeners to go there. Studies are reported there, as well as surveys of former proton patients. And with proton beam radiation therapy, for early and mid-stage patients, the 10-year disease-free survival rate is up in the high 90% range. for the more aggressive prostate cancers, all localized prostate cancers, it's less than that, probably in the high 80s. With surgery, I would guess that percentage-wise, it's probably 5 or 10% less. So I believe proton has the edge on surgery and, in fact, all the other treatment options because it treats the body so kindly.
What happens? Let's say you do get proton beam radiation and the cancer comes back. What are the backup options? Can you have your prostate taken out then?
That's certainly an option. Every case is different, Jim, and it depends upon the specifics of that case. What you would typically do is you would do some tests, imaging tests, and possibly a biopsy to determine where the cancer is, if it does return, and also measure the aggressiveness of the cancer. If it's many years after treatment and the cancer returns, typically it's a slow-growing or indolent cancer that in many, if not most cases, can be ignored. Because, you know, it might take 30 years before it grows to the point where it's going to begin to produce symptoms. And if you're 70 years old and, you know, you might say, well, you know, I'll just keep an eye on it. I'll do active surveillance. If you're a younger man and or if it's a more aggressive cancer, you have many, many options. If the cancer is inside the prostate, you can have surgery to have your prostate removed if you want. It's a more complicated procedure than a standard radical prostatectomy, but it can be done. You can have internal radiation seeds. You can have cryotherapy, liquid nitrogen. You could have high-intensity focused ultrasound. You could have focal laser ablation. You have many things. You could have hormonal therapy. If the cancer returns and it's outside the prostate, if it's metastasized, then your options are more limited. You probably would be limited to hormonal therapy and possibly chemotherapy. So there are lots and lots of options, including active surveillance if it returns many years later.
Let's talk about the coverage of proton beam. Is it covered by insurance? Because I know certain treatments are covered and others aren't, and insurance companies and even the government has been somewhat limiting in terms of what they're willing to pay. Is it covered by insurance, Bob?
The answer is yes, but things are changing. If you're over 65 and you're on Medicare, you have no problem at all because Medicare does cover proton therapy. It was approved by the FDA probably 15, 20 years ago and has been reimbursed by Medicare. If you're a younger man than 65 and you have private insurance, many private insurers cover, but some do not. Proton therapy is more expensive than conventional radiation. And there are those who feel that there aren't enough randomized clinical trials and studies that prove that proton is superior to the point where they should spend that extra money. It's really sad because you would expect that the patient would be able to make his treatment decision with his doctor rather than an insurance company. But there are some insurance companies like Aetna Insurance that have stopped covering proton therapy for prostate cancer. Men do appeal the denials, and occasionally they win the appeal, but it gets tougher and tougher as time goes on. But the time is coming when they will be approving it again as the studies are done to prove its superiority, and also as the cost comes down. There are many things going on right now to reduce the cost of proton therapy, and I think within the next 5 years, it will cost the same as conventional external beam radiation therapy, and more men will be choosing it for prostate cancer.
Bob, as we close, tell our listeners about Brotherhood of the Balloon, and then tell us a little bit about your book.
When I was in treatment 15 years ago, Jim, I became friendly with four or five other guys. As you mentioned earlier, I'm an engineer. I call myself a recovering engineer. But there are a couple of other engineers, scientists, physicists, and we had all done a ton of research before we chose our treatment option, proton therapy. And toward the end of our 8 weeks of treatment, we decided we wanted to stay in touch with each other, and we're going to share email addresses and phone numbers and that sort of thing. So I agreed then to coordinate this effort. And so I went back to my apartment and typed up a note to the other five guys, and you know, I addressed it to the Brotherhood of the Balloon. And the significance of that is that each of us, when we had our treatment every single day, part of the treatment was they would insert a rectal balloon and then fill it with water to inflate the rectum, if you will, to protect it from radiation damage, and also to push the prostate up against the pelvic bone to immobilize it for treatment. So we all had that in common. We all were males, and we all had that balloon treatment every single day. So jokingly, I refer to our group as the Brotherhood of the Balloon. I never expected others who were in treatment at that time to express an interest in joining us, and a bunch of them did. So when I left treatment in late 2000, we had 19 members of the group. Well, it kept growing and growing and growing, and today we have 8,000 members in all 50 states and in 39 countries. And if I had thought back then that we would have, you know, 8,000 members in 39 countries, I never would have chosen the name Brotherhood of the Balloon. But we stay connected with each other. We promote proton therapy. We encourage our members to give back and to support proton therapy research. Our group has contributed now more than $9 million to proton therapy research. And we also promote proton therapy because most men who are diagnosed with prostate cancer aren't going to find proton therapy because it's still, even though there are 17 centers now in the United States, it's still not that well known. So we promote it by taking a presentation that we put together, a PowerPoint presentation, and sharing it with folks at men's group meetings, Lions Club, Rotary Club, church meetings, and so on and so forth. And, you know, that's basically our mission, to share information with each other, to promote proton therapy, and to give something back. Regarding my book, I basically, when a man is diagnosed with prostate cancer, when anybody's diagnosed with any form of cancer, it's a very, very sobering experience and a frightening experience. I was scared to death. And what I went through in trying to find out about the disease and about the treatment options, I mean, that was really the low point in my life. Every book that I read was written by a doctor, and the doctor was promoting his or her specialty. I wanted to produce a book that I would have liked to have available to me when I was diagnosed. So I wrote it in layman's terms, but I tried to cover all the bases, you know, each of the treatment options, the pros and cons of each, and also understanding the diagnosis, T-score, PSA, free PSA, Gleason score, all those things. I also put in there what I refer to as the 10 steps for taking control of your prostate cancer diagnosis and treatment. And those 10 steps, by the way, are a great guideline for basically taking control of your health, not just prostate cancer. So I encourage our members to read it and have their spouses read it and members of their family. It's a very popular book. If you go on Amazon and do a search under prostate cancer, you'll find there are more than 30,000 books on prostate cancer. And we've been in the top 10 for the past 7 years, and we're currently in the number 3 position. Several hospitals now distribute our book to people who make inquiry. You can find it on Amazon. You won't find it in bookstores, but you can buy it through Barnes & Noble or Borders. But Amazon or our website, protonbob.com, you can find it there.
As we close, Bob's website, which if you are a man facing prostate cancer or think you may have it, I highly recommend Bob's website. It's called Proton Bob. That's ProtonBob, protonbob.com. The name of the book is You Can Beat Prostate Cancer and You Don't Need Surgery to Do It. Bob, I want to thank you for joining us on Lifetime Income, and I would love to talk to somebody at Loma Linda because they're having great success with women's breast cancer as well. So hopefully we can talk to somebody about that issue. But in the meantime, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. Have yourself a great 4th of July.
Thanks very much, Jim, and thanks for inviting me.
You know, that was an interesting interview because they are making a lot of advances when it comes to either prostate cancer, and there's even some new encouraging work on stem cells related to that that we're going to be covering here in the months ahead. But it's also used very effectively for women concerning breast cancer, because a lot of times when they use radiation on women, you know, there's damage effect to the lungs and the heart. And so hopefully we can cover that in a future interview. Well, as always, we've run out of time again. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.